You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for May 23rd, 2014. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the No, We Really Don't Savvy Football at That Level zone, it's the Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Happy Memorial Day weekend.
Happy Memorial Day weekend,
thanks
everyone.
To all our vets. We love you.
Love ya.
And yeah, we got about five or six very long, detailed emails about Michael Sam from some listeners who we didn't even know were out there, telling us that Michael Sam has all kinds of reasons why he would be a lower draft pick than expected. And thank you for that.
First of all, we do publish corrections. So
we are correcting ourselves.
We will always do corrections. Secondly, yeah, we both got out of our safe zone on that.
We did. And there are a lot of nuances in the draft that we had absolutely no idea about. Everyone seems to agree that Michael Sam had a lower pick than he would have had were he not gay, or were there not some concerns about notoriety in the locker room and that sort of thing, and that is discrimination. But there are also reasons why, as a college player, Michael Sam might be more desirable than as a pro player, and he might not have an easy time of it. So that was the consensus among these five or six very long emails we got from people who really know football draft, and that's cool. We didn't realize our listeners cared about that such things, and we're glad to hear from you. Thank you for correcting us. We appreciate it. And
have you noticed that? I've noticed that over the last, especially the last year.
Yeah.
That the audience has grown rather substantially.
Uh-huh.
We'd like to grow contributions at the same rate as audience members, but that's probably not.
I think we still are at the 1% mark.
We're close to that.
1% to 1.2% of our listeners in numbers donate.
In some way.
At least once. Yeah. And while we're talking about that, just to clarify for anyone who hasn't donated, when we get a donation from you, if it's a one-time donation, we send you an email back thanking you, or eventually a letter. If you mail it to us, it takes a little longer for us to get back to you. I will admit that. And that's it. Mm-hmm. And we thank you. We acknowledge the donation. And we thank you. And then your name does not go on a list. It does not go in a database. Does not get rented to anybody. It does not get sold to anybody, because we believe in the golden rule, and we hate that when that happens to us. So
we really, and also just FYI, as long as we're talking about all the behind the scenes sausage making, I don't know about you, Blue Gal, but I've gotten a whole lot of solicitations, especially in the last year, both mostly on my website, but I think through Professional Left as well. For native advertising.
Request,
just slide this little advertising in, wrap your content. You can write the content yourself, but a lot of requests to run ads, do ads. And I know people do that. I've nothing against it at all. I mean, I understand people got to eat, and for a lot of people, the time and effort they put into this sort of thing is their job. This is sort of our job. I mean, mm-hmm. we run, in essence, a small business, but we are 100% funded by user contributions.
Yep.
Period. There's no advertising. We don't sell any mailing lists. We don't solicit. The only time you'll ever hear back from us is if you send us a letter and we want to say thank you, or you ask a question, in which case 4 to 6 weeks or 18 months later, when I get around to it, I will try to answer everything.
Yes.
But we try to treat the family, the community we created here, exactly the way we will want to be treated.
Exactly.
Which is,
exactly.
You know, you're not going to get a letter from our version of Alan Grayson every 2 days.
Alan Grayson wants our list, though.
Dear Drift.
Dear Drift.
First of all, step one, don't call me Drift.
Or Frank. Don't call me Frank.
Dear Drift, have you seen the latest outrage? Send me $15.
But you know what? At least with Drift, the name you have on your Facebook account is Drift space Glass.
Yes.
Nowhere in anything have I ever typed my name as Frank. Uh-huh. And somewhere it is clearly typed.
Your parsing software is screwing up. But I mean, so we get a lot of the emails you get, a lot of the solicitations you get, and we really try to make sure that doesn't happen
from us. Yes.
At all. Because it's a pain in the ass. Although we will occasionally shake the cup and say, by the way, it'd be nice if I had a new pair of shoes.
Well, you know what? I'm not going to do that the weekend before Memorial Day.
Oh, no. No.
As you can tell, we don't plot these out either as, you know, we should really push the fundraising this weekend because blah, blah, blah. No.
We don't have a plan.
We don't have any business plan.
We do have notes, the sort of the sketch outlines of what we want to talk about generally, or else we would just be rambling, as I often do, because I have the best sound editor in the business. And
we have Google Docs up, and we are both open to the same document, so we can read our notes of what we want to talk about. But
we don't have a staff meeting before half an hour. Okay, everybody, get out there and push that fruit salad. Sell those onion treats. Those onion rings ain't going to sell themselves, kids.
Onion blossom ain't going to sell itself. You got to push it. Yeah.
Hot apple pie.
Mm-hmm.
So we try not to do that. But every now and then we'll do a fundraiser. This isn't one of those. This is just sort of a little, hello, this is how things work behind the scenes. Speaking of which,
Benghazi.
Benghazi. Yeah.
We're going to briefly talk about just a couple things in the news, and then we're going to get to the meat of what we want to talk about today, which is kind of politics and race and branding. And it's Driftglass has some very interesting things to say about that. Benghazi, you agree with Nancy Pelosi that there should be Democrats on the committee. Why?
My gut reaction was boycott the damn thing.
Mm-hmm.
Walk out, send Alan Grayson in, with a baseball bat to do the, you know, Al Capone walk around the table.
Yeah.
About enthusiasms.
Yes.
But honestly, because they're going to have this trial either way.
Mm-hmm.
And each of those congresspeople, each of the Congress persons represent, I don't know how many thousands, hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
So it behooves them to have those voices in the room. If you simply abandon the field to them, they control everything. There'll be no one there to push back. There'll be no one there to say this is bullshit. I would strongly urge them to use their time to point out the ludicrousness of this 14th congressional investigation into something that is settled and over and done with.
Mm-hmm.
And every time we bring up, isn't it tragic, and wrap themselves in the flag, ask them, you know, where were your tears during the Bush administration? Where was all this deep concern about Americans dying overseas when George Bush was shoveling people into graves and you were applauding? Where was all that concern then? That's what I want to know. And I wouldn't, if you could get a hold of subpoena power, I would subpoena Roger Ailes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'd want to hear his specific business. You want to get pissed about fundraising off of Benghazi Congress people. This is the product that Fox News sells now for advertising.
And which members of Congress have you spoken to directly about needing film
footage
for the night's broadcast on your network?
Subpoena his documents, subpoena his papers, his internal stuff, all the, and you know, get a hold of the guy who wrote The Loudest Voice in the Room, which is a pretty good book, by the way, and go after Fox News. And I don't mean go after them as suppressing them. I don't, you know, this is not a First Amendment issue. This is a business issue.
No, yeah. You're telling Congress what to cut, how to investigate so that you can have film of the IRS lady giving the fifth. So let's do it about, you know, why Benghazi? Why is Benghazi so important to Fox News that you have to have this hearing? And your base, why? And hold up the fundraising letters. I also think that Hillary Clinton and any other Democrat who might be called before this committee needs to find a way to make the statement, I believe, Congressman, that you are conflating the issues surrounding Benghazi with President Obama's killing of Osama bin Laden. And I would continue to say President Obama over and over and over. And I believe you are conflating President Obama's leadership when it came to getting people out of Iraq. And they want to say the White House, this, the White House, that, and because they can't say Kenyan usurper. So they say the White House and everybody thinks evil. Say President Obama about 20 times during your testimony, because they hate that.
They do.
And I believe that was before President Obama was reelected. No, wait, that was after President Obama was reelected. That would be an interesting point if it were true, Congressman.
But I understand why you would bring it up now during an election season.
Yeah, yeah. And as you well know, President Obama is not up for re-election in 2014, but I understand you are. And I understand why it's so important to you to have optics that pretend to conflate President Obama's killing of Osama bin Laden with the tragedy mm-hmm. that occurred in Benghazi.
Because you really have no other issue to
You have no other issue to talk about. All right. So we've helped them with that. Now.
Yeah. Run with that.
A hat tip to Scott, who wrote me this morning. We are recording this on Friday. And I suggested to Driftglass that we take the weekend off because it's Memorial Day weekend. And he said, no.
No.
We're having too much fun.
The people, they need the podcast.
But I may lightly edit this podcast.
This might come across as
seeming like a Blog Talk Radio broadcast. And that is not an insult to Blog Talk Radio. As you guys, if you've listened to Blog Talk Radio, they simply get on the phone and talk. Yeah. And that's how they...
And they're good at it.
And they're good at it, and they produce the shows that way. We don't do it that way. I tend to edit the podcast and get all the sniffles and so forth out of it, but I may not do too much of that today.
There's also a great deal of chainsaw activity going on.
Oh, yeah. They're trimming and cutting down trees next door, so we apologize for that. But Scott wrote me this morning, and he wanted me to remind everyone that Crystal Ball on MSNBC said, Republicans, quote, feel like the only way they can beat Hillary Clinton is if she has brain damage. It's sort of pathetic.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, and it is. So she's either got to be brain damaged or she's got to be the monster that they have always tried to make her into.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so let's get to the meat of our podcast now. And
let me just shout out to John Fugelsang on that same thing, who tweeted this morning. The Republican Party this morning explained to me that Barack Obama is both Neville Chamberlain and Hitler.
Yeah, yeah. So, and John Stewart said that right at the beginning of Obama's first term, too.
Yeah.
You can't have him be a pussy and also be Satan at the same time. But apparently you can.
Yeah. If you're schizophrenic, you can.
You can, yeah.
So let's move right along to a letter.
We have a letter from Stephen in California. And he heard our episode where we read a letter from Rick James. And so I think we're going to start calling these not Dear John letters, but Rick James letters.
Yeah.
Where people write wonderful letters to us about their relationships with conservative family members.
Yeah.
And Stephen's is a little heart-wrenching, but I really appreciated it. A bit of history is necessary to describe my childhood. I grew up in a very small Midwestern town that was 99% white. Really, 99% white. This is not hyperbole. And we all know that Michelle Bachmann's district is about 98% white. There are just districts that are like that.
It's 120% white.
There you go.
Yeah.
Like many similar communities, we had several factories and a good number of union members that worked at these factories. We also had a very robust agricultural economy. This created a mix of Blue Dog Democrats and Blood and Soil Republicans in the community.
Uh-huh.
So in the farmer's market of ideas, we had a, quote, interesting, unquote, mix of right-wing to extreme right-wing opinions.
Yeah.
In my childhood, I witnessed open and vicious racism, religious intolerance, rampant hatred of homosexuals, and utter contempt for differences.
Yep.
Many members of my own family, my parents included, were part of this. My father was openly hateful of all other races. My mother wasn't openly hateful, but she did believe that white people should be in charge. I recall that during the 1988 presidential campaign, my mother and I were watching the news, specifically a segment about Jesse Jackson's campaign. Mom asked me if I would ever vote for a black man to be president. I told her, sure, if I think he's the better candidate. This horrified her. I then received a lecture about how if a black man was ever in charge of this country, he'd do to us what we did to them. He'd bankrupt the country with reparations for slavery and other similar crazy things. At one point, I interrupted her and said, you know, maybe black people don't want revenge on us. If they do, maybe we should treat them with kindness and respect so that they won't want revenge on us. This was apparently the wrong thing to say. Mom talked to Dad, and Dad screamed at me. I don't remember exactly what he said, but it was vicious bullying and ultimately heartbreaking. After that, I swallowed my pride and didn't speak up for a long time.
Okay, one brief aside.
Mm-hmm.
The great white terror
mm-hmm. yep.
about race is that not only are black people better than us because they survived harder times than we will ever imagine. But that if we were in their position, we would kick ass if we ever got the chance.
Mm-hmm.
We are smaller and pettier and more vengeful. Therefore, we're terrified of the golden rule.
Mm-hmm.
But they will do unto us what we would goddamn well do unto other people and have done unto other people. And we can't possibly perceive of another group of people as being kind and humane and complex and simply wanting to live in this country peacefully and equally.
And we're going to talk more about that after we finish the letter.
Anyway.
This isn't to say that things have always been difficult with my parents or that they were bad parents. Dad and I would play catch, watch the Three Stooges and Westerns. They sacrificed so that I could go to college. And no matter what else happened, they've never missed a Christmas or birthday. I know that they love me and want only what's best for me. Our differences have always been a source of tension, and in the past 6 years, they've gotten worse, especially with my father. For years, I silently tolerated his repeated lectures about how I was stupid for believing as I did. Then around 2003, I started arguing back, but he would just double down, switch subjects when I had backed him into a corner, and claim that Democrats were worse.
Shocking.
Shocking. I would eventually throw up my hands and walk away until the next time. Since the 2008 election, Mom and Dad have gone off the deep end. They fervently believe whatever crazy things Fox News tells them to believe. Dad more so than Mom. Most of the time, she just wants to have a pleasant holiday, whereas he wants an argument. Since the 2012 election, I've stopped throwing up my hands and walking away from my arguments with Dad. Instead, before I respond to him, I ask him, "Are you sure you want to have this discussion?" Sometimes he looks at Mom and then remarks about the weather we're having lately, but most times he said yes, and we have an argument. Sometimes I think Driftglass is right. There's no reaching some people. Maybe my parents are so far down the path that there's no turning back. There's no chance for redemption for them. But these are my parents, and I've seen the kindness they are capable of. I watched my father cry when he was worried that cancer was going to take Mom from us. I had a deep and sorrowful conversation with him about how my brother's children needed all of us in the aftermath of his marriage disintegrating. Mom has been a member of the Catholic Church her entire life. She volunteers at the ice cream social, she taught Sunday school, and she sings in the choir.
Uh-huh.
The day will come when they aren't with us anymore, and I'm going to be asked what they were like. I will talk about how kind they were, how hardworking they were, how important family was to them. I don't want to have to quietly whisper to myself, they also held a vicious white supremacist point of view to the very end. I can't give up on them. I can't let them die with this venom in their hearts. I'm not a believer anymore, but certain things are hard. Excuse me. I'm not a believer anymore, but certain things were hardwired into me. Despair is a sin, and I'm not giving into it. My parents are worthy of redemption, and I'll fight until the bitter end to see that they get it. Thank you for that letter.
That's a wonderful letter.
That's
wonderful.
A wonderful letter.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're gonna talk a little bit about whiteness today. And yeah. I am not an expert on critical race theory.
No.
There's a book out there called When the Irish Became White, which kind of sums up in a nutshell what some of critical race theory is about, which is for people who have skin color that allows them to do it, whiteness becomes a choice.
Yes.
Whereas with African Americans, it is not a choice. Is that a saw in the background?
Yes, I'm afraid it is.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
That's
I'm really
all right.
Sorry about that. Folks.
We're just there's nothing we can do about it. There were two New York Times articles this week, one of which outraged me, and then the other coming right on the heels of the first one just made me laugh. There is an article about the editorial, and it is entitled The Great White Hope, not in quotation marks.
No.
And I thought I had linked it on our notes, but I didn't. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
It's by Mr. Edsel, who is Thomas Edsel writes a lot. He writes weekly for the New York Times about demography, and he's a professor at Columbia. But his article, his op-ed, The Great White Hope, was about how only about 11% of Americans will tell you they are uncomfortable or bothered by the prospect of a majority non-white America. But if you put four statements on a piece of paper and hand it to people and then ask them, does any one of these statements make you uncomfortable? You can narrow down which one it is that makes them uncomfortable and find out that in actuality, while they won't admit that a majority non-white America makes them uncomfortable, about 50% of white evangelicals are made uncomfortable by that or are bothered by a majority non-white America. And about 30% of white Democrats are bothered the prospect of a majority non-white America. And so that's great news for John McCain.
It is.
And that's sort of what this article was about, was the Republican Party can still win elections because people are actually, white voters are actually bothered by this.
Figure out a way to drill a little bit deeper.
Yeah, just go a little bit. You know, they used to call it the Southern strategy. They don't call it that anymore. But, you know, it actually works with certain voters, and it might really help them in the future.
Yeah.
Okay, and nothing about the morality of that is in this op-ed at all.
No.
All right, then right on the heels of that, the next day, I came across an article in the New York Times again about how from 2000 to 2010, Latino and Hispanic voters, a great many of them, switched their race to white.
Yeah. Well, there are multiple sub-demographic categories. In the surveys I've seen, there's Latino white, Latino black, and a very clear sort of self.
So much of whiteness among Latinos and Hispanics has to do with your ability to speak English. Are you Anglo? It becomes, are you white? And they are the same. If you are fully capable of discourse in English that does not have a strong enough accent where you actually appear, quote unquote, I know this sounds terribly racist, but the point is, this article said Latinos and Hispanics who cross over and become really just English-speaking Americans no longer think of themselves as non-white because they have become Anglos. They've become English-speaking people.
Join the club.
That is the dividing line in their mindset between being a white American and being a minority is the language barrier, not the skin color. And that makes a lot of sense. Well, a lot of the anxiety that anti-immigration folks have about Hispanic immigrants is English only. You know, we need English only.
A lot of the anxiety they claim. I mean, that's code for I don't want those people in my country. But it's
a lot of the fear is, at least from the old people I've talked to, not at this church, but at other churches I've belonged to, is they don't want to press one for English because that means
that's too much.
That's a bridge too far.
I was on the phone the other day and they asked me if I wanted to speak English or Spanish.
Yeah, am I an American or am I not an American? We're
what
English.
Country is
English. This is America. Speaking. And the thing is, I've said this before, but Benjamin Franklin wrote an editorial in a Philadelphia newspaper about the Germans.
The damn Germans.
Damn Germans don't speak English. They take all the good jobs. They're stinky.
They smell bad.
They don't belong here.
They're probably basically criminal.
Yeah.
You know? And they're basically ruining it for white America.
They're ruining it for white America. Exactly. So there was a time when Germans were not white in America.
Well, don't
get us started about the Irish. Yeah.
Yes.
So
seriously, don't get me started.
Don't get us started about the Irish.
That's the rest of the podcast right there.
Right there. We've been watching the first season of Mad Men, which is about white America, white male, straight America.
Well, it's all about white America.
Yeah. And I'm going to use the word incursion because that's the feeling that you get from this show.
Yeah.
Of, you know, in season one, blacks are waiting on you in the bathroom and serving you a sandwich at the automat.
Right.
And
that's it.
As the series progresses, it becomes necessary to have African-American secretaries in the office. It becomes necessary, and it's spoken openly in this series as being a necessary evil that we have to do this.
And if they get too chummy, there's always a white supervisor on hand to step in and pull them back.
Yeah.
you know, is he getting too friendly with you, sir?
Yep.
That kind of thing. Because it's, yep, you know, that's, you're crossing a caste line at that point.
Yep.
And that's completely verboten. And the thing about this is, the show creator, and this really does tie directly to what we're talking about, Matthew Weiner, has said many, many things. And in response to complaints he heard from boomers, because he's a cusp kid. I mean,
he's a Gen X kid.
Yes. He's a Gen X kid. I'm right on the cusp of being a cusp kid. I'm almost there. I'm not a boomer. I don't.
Let's define our terms. As I define baby boom versus Gen X.
Yeah.
If your parents were old enough to serve in World War II.
Yes.
And you were born during that time of 45 to 65. And your parents are old enough to have served in World War II. You're a boomer.
Uh-huh.
There's a huge difference between being the first child of somebody that was born in 1936.
Yep.
And being the sixth child or the third child or the whatever, later birth.
Exactly.
Of older, somebody that was born in the 20s and served in World War II.
Yeah. Oh, there is. And
so.
Well, and he makes the case that in response to complaints from boomers that, you know, that have all these really fond memories, mm-hmm, of this period. Mm-hmm. He said, this isn't your story.
Yeah.
This is your parents' story. This is your grandparents' story.
No.
Story.
It's all about me.
Yeah.
No, it isn't.
But the point, and there's several elegant ways in which this was demonstrated, but one of them, the idea that good old days nostalgia is driven by a longing for a particular period, an era, is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Good old days nostalgia is for what the world was like when you were six, whenever that was.
Yep.
So if you're a boomer, you have great memories of 1969. Batman was awesome. You were probably having a good summer break. You didn't notice that, you know, your parents were spending a lot of time crying because people kept dying and being assassinated. And there was this horrible war going on and on.
Yeah.
Probably went right past. It went right past me because I
sure did.
Wasn't part of my world. I was having a ball.
Yep.
So having nostalgia for a period is much more driven by when you were a baby,
mm-hmm,
than what was actually good going on there. And there's this really elegant scene where our protagonist, Don Draper, is being told to break the camera out. You never use it. And he's filming a child's birthday party.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's like every film you've ever seen of your parents.
Super 8. It's Super 8 home movies. Yeah.
And everybody's and you cut back and forth between what the camera is capturing and what will be the future memory,
mm-hmm,
and what's actually going on. Mm-hmm. And what is capturing are happy people who are smiling and kids who are blowing out candles and people running around and playing and adults sort of like making funny faces. And then you cut to what's really going on is they're drunk, they're vicious, the kids are getting slapped by adults. There's people who are right on the verge of committing adultery, right in front of everybody else. They're talking vicious smack about the divorced lady down the hall. It's an unhappy, competitive, mm-hmm, drunken environment. And that's what it was
and
really
it's an
like.
Afternoon kids' birthday party, right. and the adults are getting drunk, cheating on each other, and as you say, just being hitting on the divorced lady while calling her a slut to your wife.
Yeah.
And jokes about wives.
Yeah.
That are all about watching my wife die in a fire or by drowning.
Yeah.
And ha ha ha, isn't that funny?
But then you look at what the camera's recording, and it's happy, smiling people.
Happy, smiling
people. And so when you grow up as a boomer, what you remember is the film, Happy, yeah, Smiling People. You had no idea that what was really going on was all this other stuff. And so it does a very efficient and elegant and artful way of capturing this period.
Mm-hmm.
And the point I wanted to make during this segment here before we talk about Bob Benson and his Erector Set and so forth, which is jumping ahead to the last episode, is white America as a brand.
Mm-hmm.
A brand you grew up loving as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this wonderful little segment in the best fictional book about advertising, which I've already promoted on the show a few times, called The Space Merchants, which is about when advertisers take over everything. The entire Earth is run by advertising agencies. And this consumer is seated next to a copywriter, our protagonist, on a plane. And he's talking about how he's not been captured by advertising. He hasn't been brainwashed. And the copy editor is just laughing his ass off, going, oh, we got you. Mm-hmm. You know, you could switch to this other brand, but eventually you'll figure out a way to tear those pants and bust up that luggage, and you'll hate the color, and eventually you'll come back to us because we got you. We got you before you were born. We have taught you that you have to be a member of this team over here or you'll be unhappy. You won't even be able to articulate why you're unhappy, but you'll find a way to rejoin this team no matter how hard you fight against it. And white America is a brand. That's why people don't think of it as racism when they think about themselves and all the terrible thoughts they have about Barack Obama. That's mm-hmm. why Joe Scarborough can make a gigantic ass of himself on television and say, oh, I talk to a lot of Republicans. I talk to a lot of conservatives. Not one of them has ever said, I hate Obamacare because the president's black. Of course not.
Because you're in polite company.
Well, and they don't explain it internally to themselves that
no,
way.
No, never.
They're just very uncomfortable with this, with what this guy, with his existence. And we will obstruct everything he tries to do. And everything he tries to do is a vicious, terrible conspiracy against real America mm-hmm. and real American values. And it doesn't matter that every word coming out of your mouth is fucking crazy. It doesn't make any sense at all. Because you don't make the connection doesn't mean it's there. It all you're aware of is your brand, your Lucky Strike, your Ovaltine, your cornflakes has changed its packaging.
Mm-hmm.
And you
mm-hmm.
can't stand it. And it doesn't matter that the contents are the same. America is supposed to be about an idea. The idea of America is supposed to be this theory of freedom, this theory of democracy, this theory of we all get together and figure out how to be a country together.
And so upward mobility.
Yes. Yep. We yep. give a little, we take a little, we take a little off the top, we give a little to the bottom, we let free markets reign, but we have a little bit of a buffer against that, and everybody gets to be at the table. That's the idea. That's never been the case. The case has been, for as long as anybody can remember, basically white supremacy.
Mm-hmm. And that's why when Cheerios has a mixed race couple with a mixed race child on their commercial, there's a freak out.
Uh-huh.
And it's not, and that's taking it very literally. I know what you're talking about
yeah.
is not Cheerios, but Morning in America.
Yeah, it
that's,
is exactly.
Reagan's ad was about white supremacy.
And nostalgia.
And nostalgia. And
nostalgia for America that never existed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it was what you had as a baby, what you had as a child, was this happy world full of all these happy people. And the happy America you grew up in was run by white people.
Mm-hmm. Now, Driftglass, you were born in 1960.
I was.
I was born in 63. And part of the problem is, too, in addition to having a black president, we have a president and first lady that were born around the time we were.
Oh, yeah.
They're not boomers.
They're not boomers.
And I think there's as much of a threat. I mean, it's less apparent. But the distrust of Obama has a lot to do with his age as well
oh,
as
yeah.
his race. I was trying to think, do you remember when Martin Luther King was killed? I mean, like, remember the day?
No.
Do you remember the day that
Martin Luther King was killed, I was overseas.
Oh, that's right. You were in the Philippines.
So, I mean, it was world news. I don't remember it at all.
Remember it at all. I don't remember at all when Bobby Kennedy was killed.
No,
now,
at all.
The reason I remember Kent State in 1970 was my father was a professor at Kent State University.
Exactly.
And Walter Cronkite was talking about Kent. And Kent was on the cover of Newsweek. And so I remember how exciting it was that we were all of a sudden famous. But the concept of students getting killed, I didn't know that was happening. I didn't know that this was about a war.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I was 7 years old.
Yeah.
So I didn't know those things. What I remember about that time was watching Jonathan Winters.
Yeah.
I remember watching John. I remember watching Tom Jones. I remember all over my body. That was Jonathan yeah. Winter's line when he was Maude Frickert, you know.
Uh-huh.
And Dean Martin. I remember Dean Martin on TV. Those are the things
I'll
that my childhood.
Remember, go ahead. I'll bet you remember My World and Welcome to It.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
William Wyndham.
I love that show.
Yeah. I remember Carol Burnett. All the things that were entertaining and fun and happy.
And
I
fun
remember.
And happy. And yeah. riding my bike down the sidewalk. Getting to walk to school, you know, but we really were, and all children should be, to a certain extent, cushioned.
Yes.
From world events and being told, you know, I'd love to sit at the dining room table and say, kids, there's no future for you.
Oh, you're basically doomed.
Global warming's going to kill you.
Yeah, sorry. You're screwed. You're all screwed.
Don't say that to children.
But that's there is a real clear generational divide between mm-hmm. the boomers and their parents.
Yeah. Yeah,
As this is really the Mad Men story is the story of a bunch of people who all went to war, almost all went through the Depression, and who came out winners.
Yeah.
They won.
Yeah.
And suddenly prosperity is pouring out of everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And their kids are the ones who went to prep school, who went to all the beautiful new schools that are being built just for them.
Just for them. Yeah.
And all the television shows are just for them. And all these
My girlfriend who was born in 1946 never went to a school that wasn't brand new. Every time she graduated from elementary school, she graduated from middle school, she graduated from high school. Each one of those schools that she entered was a brand new school. She was the first person to use that cubby, that locker, that desk, that light switch. She was the first. It was always a new school for every single school she went into because they were all built for that massive lump of people that were born in that year.
And I'm going to slip into a little Mad Men talk now, if you don't mind.
Go right ahead.
And yet, right at this moment in history, 1960s, in the late 60s, early 70s, especially once the oil crash comes, because if you go look at a graph of divorce rates in the United States, and they go off the charts between like 1970, 1972, right around the, I'm sorry, 70 to 73, right around the time of the OPEC oil embargo. And this is a pet theory of mine, and I believe it's mine, and I invented it, so you can't take it. But actually, it's not. I shouldn't know where I stole it from. But even as we were enjoying television, even as we were all trying to keep up this appearance, even as the divorced person in the neighborhood was a pariah, and minorities were supposed to stay on the periphery, and they were supposed to hand us things, just be grateful to be included in the family photo, if ever. Even as that was happening on television, the thing that raised a whole lot of us, the nuclear family was vanishing.
Mm-hmm.
It was gone. I mean, Father Knows Best was an artifact of the 50s. It was not a late 60s thing. By the late 60s, the broken family was the rule.
Mm-hmm.
It was Family Affair, which was Uncle Bill raising his orphan nieces and nephews. And every time there was a broken family or a divorced family or a widowed family or whatever, there was always an adult helper on the side who was perfectly willing to wade right in and just raise those kids for apparently nothing. They were never paid. They're always an uncle or an aunt.
Mr. French.
Always happy, you know? And Alice, who is the maid? Does she get paid? She's Mary Poppins. Uncle Fred or whatever his name was on My Three Sons.
Yeah.
Hop Sing.
Uncle Charlie.
How
dare you call him Uncle Fred? Uncle Charlie.
I'm thinking of Fred McMurray.
Fred McMurray.
But you had The Family Affair, A Courtship of Betty's Father, The Beverly Hillbillies, Widower, Julia, Widower, Bonanza, Widower, Andy Griffith Show.
Yep. What? Julia was a widow, not
widow,
a
widow. I'm sorry, widow. The Andy Griffith Show, Widower, My Three Sons, Widower, The Brady Bunch.
Yep, widows, widow and widower.
Although they kept what happened to their previous marriages very vague. But it was nothing. If you wanted to see normal families as defined by the American ideal of, you know, a parent, two parents, maybe grandparent, or grandma, or grandpa living with them and an extended family, you know, 2.5 kids, the only people who were doing that were the Munsters and the Addams Family and Bewitched. The only people who had quote-unquote normal American families were the Freaks. Were the magical families, were the outsiders. And also, all of these broken families where they were able to raise kids without any problems, almost all of them had magical jobs that made it possible for them to basically afford everything. They either had the entire Ponderosa, or they were an architect, or they had some other job that gave them the economic autonomy to raise an entire family and have a career and do it pretty reasonably.
Have you ever seen the movie with Six, You Get Egg Roll?
Yes, long time ago.
Same thing. Doris Day and Brian Keith, there's Family Affair. She has inherited her husband's construction business and is running it.
Yep.
And he has his own business, but they go to a cocktail party where it is divorced people and they are both widows, and he's a widower and she's a widow. And the divorced people in this 1968 movie are all lechers and drinkers and awful people. And anyone that's, you know, in this boat of being divorced is a bad person.
Uh-huh.
But Brian Keith is in the same boat I'm in.
Uh-huh.
He lost his wife. You know, so they're decent people.
They're okay.
And this
it
is 1968.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, this is
5 years later. You could not make this movie. You could not say that divorced Americans are bad people.
Well, I think
1974.
Possibly the first divorced sitcom was The Odd Couple.
Yeah, possibly.
I'm not sure about that. But
and Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore became, you know, that became sort of, okay, now we're getting somewhere. Now we're really seeing.
You can talk about divorce and pregnancy and all the things that were happening. But all the things that were, there was this incredible tension. And this the point I wanted to make with regards to our politics and our culture and bring it right up to date is the conflict, the tension. In Mad Men, this last episode, there's a guy named Bob Benson who is gay, deeply closeted, self-aware gay man. And we know that about him. I'm not giving anything away other than if you haven't seen the last season, I apologize for it. But Bob Benson's gay and he's a social climber. He wants to establish himself as a top man in his career. And he's got this golden opportunity. He thinks he can go out to Detroit and become a big shot with Buick.
Mm-hmm.
He's been told that virtually the same. Virtually in those words. So Bob Benson attempts to assemble a family, like
yes.
assembles an erector set. He has a woman who he thinks he can provide for, and I'm sure he can. She has a child. And if he marries her, then he will create for himself a family that he can present to the world. The fact that it would make him miserable,
mm-hmm.
the fact that he could never be with the person he loves, or whoever that might be, the fact that he could never, ever, ever be out about who he really is irrelevant. He will be able to present, and he says specifically, Buick expects a certain kind of executive. So this model family that basically Madison Avenue invented, this nuclear family that's incredibly fragile, that can't really last during hard times, this stripped down, road-ready family unit that you move all over the country that has no deep roots anywhere, has no extended family to support them during tough times, has no social contact with anybody except other single families in the neighborhood they barely know.
But that's because Buick expects a certain kind of family
exactly.
to represent
Buick.
Their corporation. Yes,
and that family is not an extended family with uncles and aunts and et cetera living in a small town.
And it's not a gay couple and it's not a black couple.
Exactly. It is a white couple with kids living in a nice house in the suburbs. And if you're not that, you're not going to go anywhere in this country. The Madison Avenue fantasy of the nuclear family has now become the straitjacket that everyone has to wear.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't wear it, you're cast out. You're the divorced freak at the end of the block. You're the minority. You're the gay man.
I'd like to tie that back then into the letter we got.
Well, let me add one more thing, and then I want to get back to that letter. The second family that's emerging on this show is the family of choice. Is the family of the people you're with, who you love and you care about and whose secrets you keep and who you protect, even if you don't like them some of the time, even if it's just you and your colleague and some other person, even if it's just a pal. This other grouping of people that's voluntary and based on circumstances and companionship and love and not based on the need to present a particular face to the world, that's the other family. That's the gay family. That's the single family. That's the mixed race family. That's the family that's, I don't know, LGBT.
What's kind of weird is that that's turning into Peggy and Don.
Exactly. Exactly. So you have these two
really
Americas that are colliding with each other at this point. One is the one you're supposed to be and you can't because it'll kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And the one is that you really want to be and that in the end is the most sustainable form of family, is the most desirable, is the most supportive. It's the one that will get you through when the oil shock comes and recessions come and you're out of work. Mm-hmm. That's the family that'll look after you. Not shatter under the first recession, which is exactly, as I said, exactly what happened to the nuclear family. Yeah. It couldn't survive the 60s.
Yeah.
Anyway, getting back to the letter.
Yeah, just getting back to white America as a brand.
Uh-huh.
And what happens then when a black president is elected?
Yep.
And gay marriage becomes acceptable and you are in a community that is 99% white. You've always gone to Catholic Church. Even the Pope is disagreeing with your picture of what good is.
Yeah.
Where do you go but anger? Where do you go but resentment? Where do you go but
Fox News?
Fox News, which is going to tell you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You find Rush Limbaugh.
You find Rush Limbaugh, and he tells you exactly what you want to hear.
And you stay with him because that's the last bastion.
Yep,
that's the last place. And there's no place to go past that. Mm-hmm. Past that, you're stuck with the degenerates and weirdos and communists and liberals out there who are destroying the country that you vaguely remember existed when you were 5 years old.
You can't watch ESPN no more. They got men kissing men over there.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So it's a smaller...
And a black kissing a white man, even.
And so it's a smaller, but it's a more... And honestly, in this election, those people will probably do very well.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are a more cohesive, coherent, lockstep group of people, especially during off-year non-presidential elections, mm-hmm. than liberals are.
Yeah.
We're all over the map. They know what they want. They want their country back.
Yep. And they will vote as one to keep Hispanics out, to keep gays under wraps, for family values, with a white... successful businessman who's cheated on his wife multiple times.
Well, if you're going to split hairs, I mean, sure.
Yeah.
but as you know from Mad Men, behind closed doors, all the guys know, we all do it.
Yeah.
Hey, you're not the first guy to do this. Hey, you know, the little woman is who you keep tucked away in the suburban home. And when you're in the city, you fuck around because that's what men do.
I'm glad we had this conversation.
I'm glad we had this time together. Just to have a laugh or sing a song.
I'm grateful to Stephen in California for writing so poignantly about his family. It is tough, and I'm glad you're holding out hope for your parents. One of the things that is hardest and was hardest for me when I was in my 30s was discovering that my parents are human beings and not just my source of identity. They came to visit me at the first time I had a really nice apartment that was really decorated. And that I was proud of. And they came to see me, and Mom looked around and liked everything, and then she wanted to go home.
Yeah.
And she was just homesick. She's not a traveler. So I hope your father's going to want to go home tomorrow.
Yeah. And, you know, don't give up on your parents.
No, and don't give up. And I don't give up on my parents, but I'm saying that they're human beings. And they have fears, and they have nightmares. And... they're not perfect. And that's a very hard stage to go through. But that is the signal that you're an adult.
Yeah.
When you can recognize that they are frail human beings.
Well, and
make mistakes and have problems.
When you can tease apart their genuine desire that you be protected and be safe and have a happy life.
Yep.
From you can't marry that black person because that will make you unhappy. It'll ruin your life. Don't you know that? Well, okay.
Well, what I find hilarious about you saying that is you've often told me the story of your first wife, who was African-American.
And still is. Yes.
And still is. and how the suspicions were not your parents toward her, but her family towards you.
Yes, me personally.
You personally.
But it's only
because your mother was well known to all of them as a civil rights icon of the neighborhood.
Well, yes, she was. I was her son.
You were her son.
He's her boy. Oh, that's.
Oh, okay. That's what's he doing here? Oh, he's her. Oh, okay. And all of a sudden you were accepted because your mother's work in the community was so well known and she was known. Yeah.
I have had more stressful meetings than having to go over to the family mansion or the family home and sit in the basement and be cross-examined by lots of people I didn't really know in a room where I had to duck constantly because frankly it was – I'm tall and
the ceiling was not.
So it was a situation designed to put me under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
But when the elder women took me under their wing and said, "Oh yeah, no, you're so-and-so's boy. Yeah, now you're fine." It was a family thing.
Yeah.
It was you are about to become part of our family and we want to make damn sure that
you're worthy
of joining this family. And you know what? That sentiment is extremely wonderful
and
extremely protective. And it's designed to make sure that, you know, the people you love are not hurt in any way.
Yeah.
The place where it gets warped is where marrying someone you love who your parents or whatever think is degenerate or unworthy or, you know, gay or outside of your racial group or religion or whatever it is. That's where it warps, because that's where it's like, no, your desire to protect me is wonderful and noble. Your resentment of this group of people is atavistic and wrong. And I'd like you to give up one of them, and I'd prefer it to be your bigotry.
Very good. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks,
and
everyone.
I hope everyone has a nice long weekend. And if you're listening to this in the middle of the week next week, continue to listen to us through the summer. We will be recording every Friday.
Yes, we will.
Yes, we will. Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Taz, as in Tasmanian Devil. Taz earned his name when they brought him home, and he appeared to rocket around the perimeter of the apartment without ever touching the floor. Yes.
Cats will do that.
He even sleeps in action poses like Superman in flight. You'll see that at our website and Facebook page. He is sleeping. He's stretched out like Superman. And he will be 3 years old in June. Happy birthday, Taz.
Happy birthday, Taz.
You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service Go Postal Unions letter on the air unless you say otherwise. So, Driftglass, how are the internet kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Gal, the internet kitties want to go to prom with Joe Biden, too. Where's their corsage?
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-dovey. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2014, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome. Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Driftglass.
Let's do some Science Fiction University.
All right, let's do that.
Dogface Herman wrote us this week and said, I spent much of the last week taking care of 4 cats, plus 1 stray, and 3 horses all by myself. Wow. After cleaning stalls, I would have an hour or two to kill before the next set of chores, so putting together science fiction clips was a good way to relax and decompress. And here is a set of 8 audio clips.
All right.
And all you're supposed to do is name the shows. That's it. Just name the shows. That's pretty easy.
Right. Yeah, sure. Why not?
How hard can it be? Number 1.
Oh, your atmosphere. So rich in oxygen. It's like breathing in a thick chocolate malted milk.
Malted milk. Malted milk. How would a Martian know about that?
I visited here many times.
And no one you met ever suspected?
Not even Thomas Jefferson. And he was a fairly bright fellow. For a native, that is.
Oh, that's My Favorite Martian.
That is My Favorite Martian.
Starring Ray Walston, and who went on to be Boothby in Star Trek Next Generation.
Number 2.
Identify.
Available data classifies them as Federation pursuit ships.
Set a course to take us away from them. Maximum speed.
Course and speed confirmed.
With our speed, we'll probably outrun them this time. But they'll keep coming. Pushing us, tracking us, they'll never give up.
Nor will we. When we can handle this ship properly, we'll stop running. Then we'll fight.
All right. Well, it's clearly British, and it's clearly a TV series, and it clearly ain't Doctor Who. So that limits the field of possibilities down to like 2 or 3. And I'm just going to guess it's Blake's 7.
How did you know that? I've never even heard of that show.
Yeah, I will confess, I have never watched an episode of Blake 7.
But you know that there's like 3 science fiction shows from the BBC
that have that production quality and have that kind
of... You mean that lack of production quality.
Yeah, that were done in like, you know, the 70s or 80s and don't have much of a budget. So it has to be that one. I've heard people talk about it. There are several series I have never seen that people have told me, how did you never see this? And I never did. But I know it exists. And by process of elimination,
You guessed right on this one. Yeah, huh? That's amazing. I might have to go check out some Blake's Blakes 7, 1978 to 81. So it lasted a few seasons, too.
It did. It did. Well, it lasted, I think, BBC seasons, which are a little bit television.
Number three.
Now, 400 people work up there, and not one of them knows all this exists. I have to play games, pretending to be the studio's chief executive. No one even dreams what my real function is. That's what security's all about.
I'm sorry, sir. Sometimes it's pretty difficult.
Difficult? So you think it's difficult, huh, Ford? Well, I'll tell you when it gets difficult. Have you ever thought about the victims of UFO incidents?
Oh, Jesus. I've got no... It sounds somewhere between that Sequest thing that Roy Scheider did, and there was a program called Probe and Quest, which is basically the same show. I can sort of guess the time period, maybe early 70s, but I got no idea what the show is.
The show is called UFO. Yeah. But you're right. They were kind of precursors to reality TV shows and that unsolved mysteries. And yeah. What was the one that Leonard Nimoy hosted? In Search Of.
Well,
yeah.
Lawrence Luckenbill was in a series called, why do I know that name? Because it's so unique. In a program called the Delphi Bureau, about a guy with a photographic memory. Now, I don't know if that's science fiction or not, but a whole show built around, I'm stuck under a tractor and I remember the specifications of this tractor from the time I glanced at it, therefore I can save myself by pulling out the fuel line, is not much on which to build a show, but they built them. Yes, they did.
Well, and Suits is supposedly based on that, too. The show about the two attorneys.
Yeah.
And what was really fun about that show at the beginning was it was based on the younger attorney having a photographic memory where he could just recall entire pages of law. And that's why he passed the bar without going to law schools. He could just memorize things. And they completely forgot about that part of the show. And now it's this drama about, is his girlfriend going to go to the West Coast or not? And is his boss going to steal something that he shouldn't have had in court? And it's become bland courtroom drama. And it really had the potential to be, you know, be MacGyver with memory, you know,
I didn't realize, because I didn't watch that show until my wife insisted I watch it. You never did. I just sort of fell into the habit. But I didn't realize that was the show hook. I didn't realize that at all.
The hook was that, first of all, the hook is stupid because every attorney at this law firm in New York City went to Harvard Law School. And right. They only hire out of Harvard, which is stupid.
Right.
Secondly, this kid didn't go to Harvard Law School. No one remembers him, but he gets away in this law firm of all Harvard students with saying he went to Harvard Law School.
Because one person knows his secret.
Yeah. Only one person. Well, now it's three people. But
So it's Mad Men.
Yeah.
He can perform the job, and he scammed his way in the door, and
yes,
now they're protecting him. And I also, just because this is, we're talking a little bit of television, do you remember The Paper Chase?
Yes, sure.
Yeah. One of these students, as I recall, from this 1970, whatever it was, 2-1 movie, which is a good movie. I really liked that movie.
It became a TV show, too.
Yeah. Well, yeah. His thing was he had a photographic memory.
Mm-hmm.
And Kingsfield basically said, that will do you no good at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you don't understand how to integrate what you have memorized with the actual interpretation of the law. And he was – so the idea that you would have photographic memory plus law has some – lineage.
Yes, it does. And it doesn't help you when the judge is an asshole. So
no, that's also,
that's
also
the point.
True. Welcome to all the shit that you never learned in law school, which is basically 90% of everything. Yeah.
The judge has seen smart lawyers like you who think you know everything. Right. Okay.
I have been told on at least three non-consecutive occasions that I should become a trial attorney.
Oh.
Because I would be a very good trial attorney.
Because you're a good public speaker and arguer.
Court.
You're good in debate. Yes. But.
And I have a pair of suspenders. No, I'm just a simple country lawyer. I don't know about your big city ways. Anyway.
Number four.
Number four.
Professor.
J.C.
J.C., you know that I know that you can...
That I can turn into all manner of wild beasts in the still of the night.
Well...
And you want to tell the world about it?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Then go ahead. You'll feel better.
Well, that is the charming, delightful Manimal.
That's right. And I never missed an animal. 1983.
The only reason I know that is you're the only person in the world who ever saw that show.
I'm the one.
And you mentioned
I never missed an animal.
Uh-huh.
And they called me Franimal because I never missed an animal. The reason I never missed a Manimal was it was billed as a science fiction show, which I like science fiction shows. Watched the first episode. I went, oh, my God, this show is so horrible. It's only going to be on for 4 or 5 episodes and then they'll cancel it. I have to be the person that never misses this horrible, horrible show. So every week, for I think it was only on for 4 or 5 weeks, I would sit down with my math homework and watch Manimal.
Mm-hmm.
Never miss a Manimal. It was something else.
So you were
it was really the worst. And Brandon Tartikoff. Was on Letterman, and Letterman asked him, as Letterman is wont to do, what's the biggest mistake you ever made? What's the absolutely stinkiest show, most horrible show you ever greenlighted? And he said, Manimal.
And you said, no!
I said, yeah, I gotta go with that one. That was really a horrible show. Now we're in number 5.
Number 5.
Discharged from an asteroid near the Earth, Amanid creatures are growing to monstrous size and power at the first of the steel pressure domes at Winnenden Flats. Discovery that the purpose of the vast secret plant, planned by infected human beings, is to harbor the Amanids in the recreated conditions of an outer planet, leads to an armed riot by uninfected construction workers.
This is an early one.
It is. And I have to, once again, go to Sherlock Holmes. I have to go to deductive reasoning. Again, it's British and it's from the 50s or 60s.
Yeah,
50s. So,
50s.
I'm going to go with Alan Quatermain. Quatermain?
This one is called Quartermass 2.
That's it. Yeah.
Quartermass 2.
It's, I think it's the same guy. I have to look it up now. The same recurring character who is in 1 Million Years to Earth.
Okay.
And a couple of other science fiction movies, black and white science fiction movies of that period. Which were good. I mean, they were very good. But I think he was also the sort of detective / scholar / adventurer who solved science fiction mysteries.
Hmm.
So, but I could be conflating the word quarter. But I think it was Quatermass.
Oh, okay.
And yeah.
See, these are good ones to go and look up on YouTube and see.
Yeah.
Just watch 5 minutes of them and see what they were like. All right, number 6.
And I must say, this is all being done from memory. So you'll
we make that's the whole point.
Yeah.
It's to stump the chump.
Yeah. So far, so good. I'm not feeling bad about this one, though. So far, so good.
Number 6.
Well, look, it's Luke Skywalker and C-3PO and R2-D2 from Star Wars. Oh, they'd make much better guests than Mr. McGonagall. You're going to have to leave.
Just
Sorry.
A minute, young
Come on, let's go.
Excuse me, Master Luke, but what is this strange world we've come to?
Beats me, 3PO. Seems we've landed on some sort of comedy variety show planet.
Oh, okay. That could be 20 other things, but it's got to be the Muppets.
It is. Yeah. I didn't know that R2-D2 appeared on the Muppet Show, but that's pretty cool.
R2-D2 is a whore. Okay. R2-D2 went wherever they paid him $50. He'd show up at a kid's party. And no, I have no idea what. But I know that Star Wars got into lots of weird places.
Yes.
There was a...
Including B. Arthur at the Christmas special.
No, the Earth Day or the...
Earth Day?
Life Day.
Life Day.
Yeah, the Life Day special where you just... There was no one in it except B. Arthur and Chewbacca's parents or something.
Yeah.
It was just weird offshoot. But there was... I mean, I also did a post that we'll get to during regular podcast on Burger Chef. And there was a Burger Chef tie-in for Star Wars. So Star Wars...
Oh, my gosh.
...marketed everywhere.
Yeah.
It really did just saturate the Earth with their plastic crap. So...
Number 7.
How does a nightmare begin? For David Vincent, architect, returning home from a business trip, it began at a few minutes past 4 on a lost Tuesday morning, looking for a shortcut that he never found. It began with a welcoming sign that gave hope of black coffee.
Hush. Having a clue.
The Invaders, 1967-68. Never heard of it.
It sounded like something that... Gene Roddenberry might have rejected.
Yeah, so they made it anyway.
That period. I know he had a couple of pilots out there. He was spinning out a couple of pilots.
And finally, number 8.
Oh, I've had a terrible day. I don't know what to make of it.
Oh, what's the trouble? Can I help?
Oh, it's one of the girls, Susan Foreman.
Susan Foreman? She your problem, too?
Yes.
You don't know what to make of her?
Nope.
She lets her knowledge out a bit at a time so as not to embarrass me. That's what I feel about her. Knows more science than I'll ever know. She's a genius. Is that what she's been doing with history?
Something like that.
Oh, I don't know for sure, but so far there's been a lot of British stuff on here.
Yes,
so.
There has.
I hear a British TV show from a certain period of time with a small enough studio where I can hear the echo going through it.
Yep.
And, ergo, rather poor production values in one camera, and that could only be Doctor Who.
It is Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And Dogface Herman says, this one is easy. So let's speculate if Susan will return to the show. I say she will. And I'm actually a bit surprised that they haven't reintroduced her yet.
I miss cheap-ass robot dog K-9 myself.
Yeah, K-9. Absolutely.
But who knows what it will be now that it's Malcolm.
I know. I'm so excited. I'm so terribly excited.
I know.
Kidneys! All right.
I'm excited out of all proportion.
Out of all proportion. I'm just so excited. All right. Thank you very much, Dogface Herman, again for your help. And we'll see you next week.
And in case you're not clear, I have as much fun doing these things as I hope you guys have sending them in. So
yep.
Thank you.
And they are fun and beating you. Apparently, 10 Grain got one that you didn't get last week, and he was thrilled.
Well, I got to throw 10 Grain one every now and then. Keep his spirits up.
Keep yourself humble.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. I don't know what Darth Vader was to Luke. His cousin? His uncle? Some sort of male relation? I don't know. It's confusing to me. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, everybody. Have a great week.
Bye.